We're within the rules here. We're now reconvened. Please read the next item.
Item 108, proclaim February 2018 to be Black History Month in Portland.
Welcome, everybody, and thank you for being here today, and thank you for your patience. Portland has been greatly enriched by the collective ingenuity, creativity, contributions, culture, sacrifices, achievements, and traditions of Black Americans. A significant part of that contribution has come from the sacrifices Black families made in times of war, and specifically by our veterans. There's a lot to know about the approximately 31,000 veterans in Portland. Are our veterans finding prosperous employment or businesses? Are they getting access to the health care and to the housing that they need and that they deserve? Of the approximately 225 veterans employed by the city of Portland, 22 are Black. Today we are honored to hear Black veterans from Portland and the city of Portland workforce as they offer us some insights and personal experience. I encourage all public officials and city staff to engage the public with Black history to better understand the needs and concerns of our Black veterans. I'd like to take this opportunity on behalf of the City Council to read the proclamation that we're celebrating today. Whereas in 1915, Dr. Carter Goodwin Woodson, noted Black scholar and son of former slaves, founded the Association for the Study of African American Life and History and initiated Black History Week on February 12, 1926. And whereas, during Black History Month, all Americans are encouraged to reflect on past successes and challenges of Black Americans and continue to uphold and live up to the ideals of freedom, equality, and justice. We celebrate the many achievements and contributions made by Black Americans to Portland's economic, cultural, spiritual, and political development. And whereas the 2018 National Black History Month theme is African Americans in Times of War, a Resilient Spirit. And whereas reflection on the Black American experience in times of war helps us to remember the significant contributions and sacrifices Black Americans made for our nation, Oregon, and Portland. And whereas, in Portland, World War II is a significant marker for migration of Black families to Portland and Vanport to build and serve on ships for that war effort. And whereas, as Black veterans experienced opportunities for advancement during the war, they also witnessed repression, lack of memorialization of their contributions, and systematic withdrawal of benefits ranging from housing to health care. And whereas the housing crisis and politics of gentrification Black veterans and families faced after the Vanport floods is still very much felt in Portland. And whereas we recognize the contributions of Black community organizations, nonprofit organizations, and advocates who continue to uplift the Black community in Portland and call for racial justice and an end to economic and social inequities. Now, therefore, I, Ted Wheeler, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim February 1st through 28th, 2018, to be Black History Month in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this month. I'd like to take the opportunity now to pass this on to Kim Carty. She is the Program Coordinator for the Portland Housing Bureau. Welcome. Thanks for being here. And we'll hear some testimony from some invited veterans. And then if it's okay, we'd like to take a picture with the whole city council down front.
We would like that very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
I'm Kim McCarty from the City of Portland, Portland Housing Bureau. So, good afternoon. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and Council Commissioners. Today, on behalf of the City African American Network, we're kicking off city events for Black History Month. I'm proud to introduce our Black veterans who will share Black history, which is also America's history, from their perspective. We have three speakers today. Our first is Frazier Raymond Jr., U.S. Army retired. His group will be followed by Jonathan Ross, who served in the U.S. Marine Corps, and Havar Rakenya, who served in the U.S. Army with the 82nd Airborne Division. I'll say more about each presenter before they present, and end the presentation by inviting everyone to the atrium for dessert and to see the historic Black Williams Project. So first, our speaker, Frazier Raymond Jr., U.S. Army, is retired. He's president of the Buffalo Soldiers Pacific Northwest Moses Williams Chapter, and he's joined by T. Sharp, Sergeant of Arms. The Moses Williams Chapter is committed to preserving and recognizing the contributions and commitment of the Buffalo Soldiers. The Buffalo Soldiers of the Moses William Pacific Northwest Chapter are involved in various community service activities, including flag-bearing ceremonies, mounted cavalry, units in the Rose Festival Parade and the Hollywood Parade, camping trips, lunch events for inner-city youth. And the chapter is also developing plans to create a housing program that would offer shelter to young adults and families.
Thank you. Well, as she said, my name is Frazier Raymond Jr. I come out of Louisiana in 1950, and I joined the military at 18. I'm kind of nervous, though. But anyway, I went in at 18. A combat veteran at 20, and I went on a It's been 22 years, 10 months, and 17 days on active duty. I didn't think I was going to get this emotional, but I'm married, the father of three children. They're all grown. I have a stepdaughter. She's about to graduate from college after 3 years. My wife and I live in Northeast Portland. I've been in Portland roughly, I guess, 17 years. I came here 2001, and I attended Portland State, where I studied urban planning and community development, where I learned just enough to go home and stay out of everybody's way. So I fished for a while. I just kind of, you know, when you come out of a regimental lifestyle, and then you go into one where, for me, you know, civilian world seems to me like half the time nobody's in charge. Now, I understand as a, you know, the mechanism in place, whatever, but when you're coming from a structured environment and you come to one that's not as structured, you have to find your place all over. I went in the military at 18. I came out at 40. I knew that structure. I served the government in various capacities. I served around the world. I've been to some places. We traveled a two-person team. But I did what I had to do for my country. But anyway, I retired here, and I recently joined the Buffalo Soldiers. And there's a man by the name of Bill Morehouse. He just recently passed away. And I'm still running errands for that guy today. He was a World War II veteran. And he served at Vancouver Barracks. He lived at Vancouver Barracks. They're going to honor him with a plaque and a bench and a tree in front of the barracks he lived in. But Mr. Morehouse served in a segregated army. He would guard the Italian and German prisoners of war. They were allowed to go places in Vancouver where he had to stand outside and watch them. But he did his duty. And that's one of the reasons I'm still the Buffalo Soldier. I'm still serving today. We're a small outfit, but we are United States Army sanctioned. And as far as the Buffalo Soldiers go, they've served from the time of Crispus Attucks until now. And the Buffalo Soldier, even though the designation has been changed, the 10th Cavalry still exists. So therefore, the spirit of the Buffalo Soldier exists. And as long as there's an American and an armed force, the Buffalo Soldiers will continue to serve. They served in the Philippines. The unit that was stationed at Vancouver Barracks, 24th Infantry, was the same unit that went to the Philippines. Teddy Roosevelt went up San Juan Hill, 10th Infantry Cavalry that led him up that hill. History bears that out. Moses Williams is buried in Vancouver Cemetery, the National Cemetery of Vancouver. Moses Williams became an ordnance NCO, one of the first African Americans to attain that position. It was a position and not a rank, because the ordnance NCO was responsible and he was assigned to the installation, not a unit. To make a long story short, Fort Stevens, they took the garrison from Fort Stevens and sent them over to nearby Fort Canby because that was under repair. Since the Army promoted Moses Williams to an ordnance NCO, it's like, what do we do with him now? Well, let's send him out to Fort Stevens where he can serve by himself for 2 years, which he did. At the end of his two-year assignment, Fort Canby was, the repairs were completed, and history tells us that history says that the old soldier retired after 37 years of faithful service to his country, but he was forced out. He came back to Vancouver where he died a year and a half later. And like I said, this chapter is named for him. And as long as the Buffalo Soldier spirit is alive, this chapter will live. Thank you.
Thank you. I overread my time, didn't I?
No, you did.
Back,
you're very welcome to sit down or share more if you like. Thank you so much.
We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Jonathan Ross. Come on up, Jonathan. Jonathan is a United States Marine Corps veteran. Part of his 6 years of service include responsibility for ensuring the successful operation of food services, recreation facilities, employee services, and administration of funds acquired by the association, totaling over $2 million. Now he's a full-time student and does work study for the Public Affairs Office for the Veterans Healthcare System at OHSU.
That's great. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Like she said, my name is Jonathan Ross. First and foremost, I would like to thank everyone who made this opportunity possible for me. It's an honor to have the spotlight and share a bit of my perspective with you all. I grew up not too far from here, and I've lived in multiple parts of this city. Originally, I saw this world very different, as we all would surmise. I saw this city as a child with minimal understandings. Depending on people around me, my peers and role models, like we all naturally do, I began to take root and grasp similar concepts of ones I admired, respected, and looked up to. Along with this admiration naturally came a responsibility to protect, which led me to where I am today. I remember walking down the hallway in my high school and seeing military branches organizing push-up challenges. You know what I did? I did those push-ups. And to be honest, I had no idea the difference between the branches. I had actually joined the Army DEP program before the Marines and saw the Marines work a little bit harder, so kind of switched teams. My recruiter didn't lie to me when he told me it's not going to be easy and that much sacrifice will be required. And at a young age, when we sign such a daunting contract, none of us really realize the true commitment that we're about to take. So 2 months after graduating high school, I was going through a very painful process, Marine Corps boot camp. Nowadays, I tell people my horror stories, and I get responses like, "Oh, that's terrible. How could you do that?" People always perceive the experience as terrible, extremely difficult. But what I find that is most funny is nobody ever asked how did all 80 of us live in one barracks for 3 whole months. We were all from different states, different colors, came from different cultures and had different beliefs from all walks of life. But you see, the hardest part within the Marine Corps is to recognize that we're all equal. It only took a few months for us to grasp this. It's taken the country a little bit longer, but we're getting there slowly. So after boot camp comes Marine Corps combat training and then primary job, as it all is. And to my knowledge, at that point, we'd work for some time. But no, you get thrown into the fire pretty quickly. I had about 3 months to learn my job and then endured about 6 months in a combat zone using those skills. 19 years old in Afghanistan really puts a perspective on a young mind. I spent many nights wondering where my friends were doing in college. And war itself is such a nasty business, I'd rather not bore you with timeless delusions of grandeur. After my combat deployment, I felt compelled to continue serving my brothers at a higher capacity. I wanted to make monumental changes in the world that I lived in. In Afghan, I started this process of becoming a Marine security guard, one of the most prestige special duties in the Marine Corps. In my first application, it was denied. No matter, try again, you know, try harder. And through perseverance, I made that job my job. Long story short, extreme training conditions, they were so subtle, it was almost poetic. Nonetheless, I was persistent. I didn't see failure as an option. No Marine sees failure as options. At this point in life, failure was foreign to me. They became more like speed bumps. Yeah, they slowed us down like they do all people, but they're never meant to stop us. I continued to do that on my first post in Bogota, Colombia, where I lived for 2 years. I became a defensive tactics instructor for the ambassador's private detail. I provided security for notable VIPs like Mr. Joe Biden and many others. I had opportunities to gather knowledge and insight from gentlemen like Eric Holder and Secretaries of Defense and many other esteemed men and women. And still, may I remind you, as a young black man, no more than 22 years old at this time, doing all this work, being a Marine 24/7, 7 days a week, is no task. It's no easy task. There is a sacrifice needed in every choice, and with sacrifices come opportunity. So after South America, I went back to Islamabad, Pakistan, where I continued my duties and also became a Marine Corps martial arts black belt instructor. That consisted of a lot more training and a lot more pain, and I think we can safely assume you all know what I did. I got through that school with a lot of style and perseverance. Later that year came even more great opportunity. I was elected by the embassy to take the responsibility of vice chairman for a multi-million dollar association. And I can't even get into the details of a monster of a job that was. But as a 24-year-old Marine, the only thing I knew, again, was failure was not an option. I held that position until I left Pakistan, where I was given plaques and letters of recommendation. And I'm very grateful for that experience that I had. I've always been a man of extreme focus. And as I started to transition out of the Marine Corps, which is always an incredibly agonizing process, which I plan to do something about in the near future, I received several overseas job opportunities, jobs that paid a heck of a lot more than jobs I could get back home as a 24-year-old black kid. I had an amazing skill set, but still had to compete with the education factor. And our education is extremely important. So naturally, I chose contracting for a while, avoiding the inevitable process of coming back home and trying to blend in. What most people don't realize about the military is there's a shared pain. It kind of acts like a social glue. It fosters cohesion and solidarity within groups. And between those shared painful experiences, and as a black Marine, it made no difference what color I was, nor the societal bias, we are all still equal. I returned feeling like a completely different person, more or less more confident. I had a sense of self and a sense of purpose. And at that point, I didn't realize that the preconceived ideas and misconceptions that society was putting on me before I stepped off the plane. And I think a lot of us struggle with that reality. When I returned to Portland, I realized a hard truth. I left this city with one mindset, and when I came back, my perspective had changed based off my experiences in other countries. And I no longer felt at home. The society that I grew up in no longer felt familiar. And I'm not going to lie, the transition from Marine to student is difficult, and from active duty Marine to veteran is challenging. Nonetheless, we persist. I'm not just another entitled millennial, which is loosely thrown around. I'm not just a 26-year-old black kid that grew up in Northeast Portland. Society assumes a lot of things about us. I'm a proud Marine, a dedicated college student, and a resilient black man. I've been to about 6 out of the 7 continents in around 22 countries, and I'll end with this. The framework in which we structure our societal norms is the same framework that I believe causes such a platform of disconnect and tension. It's more than I've seen in any other country, and the solution is, simply put, it's in our everyday lives. I truly believe Portland, which is why I love Portland, I think it's going to be a front runner for changing this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's Maverick. He's my companion. He's awesome.
All right.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Javar Rakenya. Come on up. So, Javar Rakenya is a member of the City African American Network. He's been with the city for 5 years as a finance staff person in the Office of Management and Finance. He spent 8 years in the U.S. Army with the 82nd Airborne Division. He has multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. He wants people to know, as a vet, everyday life sometimes has a difficult task for issues ranging from PTSD to injuries sustained within the time of service.
Thank you.
Okay, my check. Okay. How everybody doing today? My name is Javar Rakenya. I'm originally from Nassau, Bahamas. This is where I was born. From then, I moved to Miami. I was like 1 or 2, and then spent 10 years in Miami. Then I moved to Atlanta, Georgia. So I'm a Georgia boy, I kind of claim it. I'm a big fan of boiled peanuts. You should enjoy it. I played sports in high school. I was a track and football star. Thought I'd get some couple scholarships, but they kind of failed out. So I was supposed to go to the University of Florida to run track, but they got in trouble with some sanctions with the NCAA, and so I didn't go run track for them. Ended up doing 2 years of community college in Atlanta, and I just didn't have enough money to go to school. As most kids in the inner city, money is kind of an issue. So I ended up joining the military because I wanted to get out of Atlanta, try to do something different, see if I could actually do it, really. So I went there, go to MEPS, you meet your recruiter, they take you to MEPS, that's where you figure out what your job's going to be. End up going to getting a job as a combat engineer, and then end up getting a 80s airborne slot. So I said, what is that? So you jump out of airplanes for a living. I was like, okay, that sounds awesome. Let's do that. So I end up signing for that. Not a really good choice. My body definitely feels it now. End up going to Fort Linwood, Missouri. Spent a harsh winter summer there. It was kind of crazy. Mosquitoes about as big as our bodies. But it was great. End up doing that, going to AIT. That's where you kind of learn how you do your job and stuff like that. End up taking a bus ride from Missouri back to Georgia, to Fort Benning, Georgia, to go to airborne school, which is great. Kind of scary when you figure out you get ready to jump out of an airplane for a living. That's kind of what you do. See a lot of injuries. People shoot don't open, or people land in trees because of the wind. Kind of land on their face when they're trying to get out of their chute. Happened to one girl I kind of felt bad for. She actually didn't graduate because of that. Ended up going to the 82nd Airborne Division. To my surprise, I was told, don't make any big purchases. We're getting deployed in 3 months. Don't buy a car in a house, nothing like that. So I ended up going to Afghanistan in 03 as a 21-year-old. Whole new world. When you're on the plane going to Germany, he was like, okay, we're going to war. Really don't know what that is because it was kind of all new to us. Ended up opening the airplane once we got to Afghanistan. It was real. When you open that door, you feel the heat. You're at war. Everybody got serious, and it was time to go battle. So in Afghanistan in 03, this was kind of in order the beginning of the war almost, there was not a lot of things there. And so when we went there, it was definitely a lot of sandstorms. Never been used to that, especially being from the south. I don't even know what that was until it hits you, and you can't really see in front of you. There's no stars on that side of the country, so it's pitch black dark at night. So it's really hard to see. So you had to carry a flashlight with you at all times. End up going to Kandahar, doing missions out of there, and end up going to Bagram Airfield. That's up north in Afghanistan, doing missions out of there. I became part of a QRF force. My job was to protect the president of Kabul. So if he ever got engaged, there was ever an issue, my team would go take care of those guys, as well as other groups like Special Forces, Army Rangers, Marines, anybody who went down. It was our job to kind of help them get out of the situation. So that was crazy. Plus, my helicopter almost crashed 9 times while doing those kind of missions. Oh, yeah. Yeah, 9 times. One time, the engine actually stopped propelling in midair. And so as we're falling down, we're like everybody bucking their chin strap. It's like, okay, this is how we go. So everybody kind of holds on to one another. And all of a sudden, as inertia, I guess, as the helicopter almost crashed, the wind kind of helps the propellers propel again. And we're going to continue our mission. I'm like, okay, guys, it was false alarm. So everybody kind of relaxed again. That's kind of how the Army guys, kind of how we are. We're a little off. So been there. I spent 13 months in Afghanistan, that was my first deployment. Ended up going to Iraq a couple times. So my last year in Iraq was in Ramadi. I was like, you see, west of Baghdad. So it was like Fallujah. Everybody knows about Fallujah, but Ramadi was the next city over, which was pretty bad. When we got there, the country was pitch black dark. There was no lights on at night. And if we were, our patrols would come through, people would flash their lights, let the enemy know we were coming, and we have on all the lights. You could pretty much see us from miles and miles away. It's like, pretty much, please shoot at me. We kind of want bullets to kind of ricochet off the vehicle so we can feel alive in some instances. Did a ton of missions out of there. There was a good book called Extreme Ownership, written by a Navy SEAL who was deployed the same time he was. I know this Navy SEAL as well. And it's a pretty good depiction of exactly what was going on in Ramadi at the time. It was a pretty bad area, pushing out Al-Qaeda, Taliban, whoever it was. And it was a lot of ambushes. We got ambushed a lot there. In some instances, in some FOBs, some forward operating bases, you see bullets fly over your head as a daily occurrence. Like it was nothing new to see bullets fly over your head, or bullets getting, or RPG'd, or grenades lobbed from rooftops. That was kind of like a norm. It got to the point to where you could hear certain sounds, like an AK-47, M4, a 240 Bravo, mortars, and you know exactly what it is, or like vehicle-bound IEDs or an IED. Because of the explosion, because you hear it so commonly, you know exactly what it is. There are some instances to where we got bombed in the base, a couple of mortars landed. Some were duds, and we were walked past it. Oh, look at that dud. Oh, it didn't go off today. And that was a daily norm for us, especially in Iraq. And from there, I took a 300-pound IED to the face and survived. I was a bomb of a hole, 8 feet wide, 6 feet deep. So IED is pretty much a roadside bomb. It's pretty major. I should be dead, honestly. It was a pretty big blast. But I had a brain bleed. I was blind for 24 hours and had internal bleeding. I had to get medevaced out. And that's when I knew I was done. I was pretty much done with the military at that point because I almost died 1,000 times. I think that was my last life, in a sense, of Contra. I used them all 50. It was kind of crazy. But yeah, that was it for me. And so after that deployment, we came home, demobilized, and found out, well, this is what happens when you come back from overseas, when you come back from pretty much hitting the gas hard, and they say, okay, now you're back, don't kill people, goodbye. That's all we got. There was no, here's counseling, here's a chiropractor to go to, none of that. And I found out I had an issue with my spine I didn't know about, and I had to go to a chiropractor to get fixed. And the military doesn't have any chiropractors, so I'm not sure anybody even knows that. They don't have chiropractors. When you carry 80 pounds of gear plus a backpack that weighs 120 pounds, it compresses your spine. And like, sure. And the military doesn't do anything for our backs at all. So no issues for the concussion. And I had one. I came all the way back and found I had a brain bleed because I couldn't remember anything. So I would go to school. I finally ended up going to school. I would read something, and I couldn't regurgitate the information because I had a brain bleed in my left hemisphere of my brain that I didn't know about. So I had to go to a CAT scan. I had to get 9 of them because they know the size of it. It was about the size of a dime that I would suffer from overseas. So I had a traumatic brain injury. And so then on top of that, going to school and having PTSD, it's a totally different monster. It pretty much tells you a 180 of your true self. So if you're a confident, happy, go-lucky guy, it makes you the whole 180 of that. It pretty much the whole total opposite of you. So I was very second-guessing myself. I wasn't confident. I wasn't happy. I wasn't anything. I was pretty much a sad shell of myself, in a sense. So that took about 2-3 years for me to get out of that. Going to counseling, get a medication. The medication they give you, because I could only sleep 45 minutes a night. I couldn't sleep longer than that. My mind, my body would not allow me to do that. So the medication they give you, it puts you right out. Like, you have to sleep 8 hours. You have no dreams. You don't remember anything. You don't do anything. You sleep like a rock. But then if you don't sleep the 8 hours off, you're groggy. You're like, your mouth is like, it's pretty bad. And that's all they give you. There's the counseling, the VA, they don't do a lot for veterans. And not just being African American, but just veterans, period. We're suffering as a whole. 22 veterans kill themselves a day. The trauma we go through, I mean, I've seen the whole human body exposed to oxygen. The whole human body. And that's something I had to deal with for the rest of my life. So if I didn't have counseling, that's something, if I never talked to anyone, if I never did anything with that, I would be reliving my dreams over and over and over and over again. It's not a good feeling. It's not at all. So the VA doesn't do anything for us in that instance. I mean, they're trying their best, but it's not enough. We need more. I mean, if the city could definitely help out with veterans with that, that would be great. I know it's a tall task because a lot of us out there. But we are out here and we're hurting. We definitely could use some help. So after that, end up going to school, finish my bachelor's, master's degree, end up trying to get a job. That was a difficult task. Period. A veteran, not veteran. It's really hard out here trying to get a job. I interned for a whole year to finally get a job in the city. I interviewed like 13 times. My interviewing skills were poor, I said much. As a veteran, as a military guy, we're short. So you ask this question, we pretty much say, blah, 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 that's it. We will never go into detail of what's that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, because we're not used to that. Our stuff is short. If you say, hey, this is how you are, affirmative, that's it, or copy, continue mission. It's simple. It's simple stuff. So one of the instances, we just need more, especially in the job market. Maybe it's a way you can reach out to the VA, maybe look at some veterans who are looking for a job and don't really have the skills. Maybe we can do something to assist those veterans with PTSD and people that are hurting, who don't really know where to go or what to do. That would be grandiose for us. I'm trying to think what else. That's pretty much about it. I mean, it's... I've been working for the city for a while, and it's been great for me, especially being a veteran, helping other veterans, talking to other veterans around the city. There are some great ones in the city. That's what's awesome. I mean, the people y'all have recruited to work in the city, they're great. There's a ton of us that are in the city, and we're just happy to be here, happy to help out, happy to just be part of whatever you need us to be a part of. I mean, the thing about veterans is that we're positive people, especially we've been through hell and back. And we've seen it all. I mean, it's pretty much nothing you can do to us that will make us feel bad, because we'll push our body to the brink and returned. And so we know what the bottom is. But we just need help. We just need y'all to do your job as a city and definitely give us a leg up, because we definitely use it. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Tosin, are you here? Tosin, come on up, please. Please, please, please. Irene, are you here? She's downstairs. Okay. Just a few more comments. And Sholanda, are you here? No. Okay. Thank you. So I first and foremost want to thank our co-organizer, Tosin, and Irene from PBOT. Thank you. So you may have noticed that most of our presenters were men, and of course, women are also serving. I did ask some women to present today, and unfortunately they could not, but they asked me to share a few comments from them. So let's not overlook the black women veterans in Portland. The women that could not be here today want to say that there's a lot that the city can do for veterans that veterans cannot do for themselves. For example, the Veterans Administration healthcare system is failing black women. For reasons systemic to the Veterans Administration and for reasons of sexism and racism. Health issues for female veterans include being vulnerable to more violence after initial military service injuries. I was also asked to remind all staff to understand and use the Veterans Preference System here at the City of Portland when hiring and when recruiting black veterans, and recognize the skills that veterans learn during service translate into skills that we seek at the city, and they make for a very skilled workforce. So thank you for listening. We're going to invite you all to take a photo with our presenters today, and then to join us downstairs in the atrium. We have an exhibit, the Black Williams History Project, and then we also have some additional speakers, specifically one of the organizers from the first Black History, help me, festival. And it's going to be one of many in the coming years. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, colleagues, I'd invite you to say something at this point if you'd like. Commissioner Fish, did you want to start?
Well, I just want to make one comment, Mayor. And first, I want to thank everybody for joining us and thank our heroes for testifying and sharing their stories. And yes, we do have a veteran's preference, and we have to be scrupulous in applying it, and we need to do a better job of outreach. I just want to share one quick story. I watched the State of the Union last night, and I couldn't help but think about Barack Obama. And I remember his State of the Union and how it lifted us. And we all have our own views of last night's State of the Union, which I felt was a very divisive speech. But I've only been invited to the White House once in my life, and it was because Senator Wyden arranged a visit. And I went with Bernie Foster from the Scanner, and I went with George Hocker, who works at the county. And the ceremony was the President of the United States awarding the Medal of Honor to Henry Johnson. And there was an undercurrent in some of the presentations today about how the military in the last 100 years has treated the black soldier and the extra burdens faced by the black soldier. Well, Henry Johnson was a member of the 369th, the Harlem Hellfighters, and he was considered one of the bravest men of his generation. He ended up dying a pauper on the streets of Albany, forgotten. But it turns out he was a very, very brave man, but there was no way for America to officially recognize his service because in the Jim Crow Army, he was not allowed to wear the uniform of the United States. So he fought wearing the French uniform, not the American uniform, even though he was fighting the same war on our behalf. Well, because the French government acknowledged him to be the bravest soldier who had ever worn their uniform, and they awarded him the Croix de Guerre with palm, it took 100 years for this country to recognize this man's service and bravery. And it took the first African-American president, Barack Obama, to actually insist that he get the Medal of Honor, our highest award. And I want to acknowledge also the fact that Bernie Foster, who was the publisher of the Scanner, wrote an award-winning series of stories about Henry Johnson. And it was our senior senator who then got involved to make sure this wrong was righted. That's 100 years ago. And he fought to defend our freedoms, but wasn't allowed to wear the United States flag uniform and did not fly the United States flag, flew the flag of his state. So we've come a long way and we have a long way to go. But the stories we've heard today of African-American leaders in our community serving is very inspiring. And our city would be foolhardy not to find ways to hire more veterans because obviously these veterans would bring distinction to our city. So thank you.
Very good.
I'm glad you came back up, because your story was reminding me of the first director of the Office of Equity and Human Rights, Dante James, an African-American who was military security, did security for First Lady Hillary Clinton, and then did a phenomenal job of our first 5 years of the Office of Equity and Human Rights, and we would not be where we are as the city of Portland or the wider city of Portland without his leadership. And so I hope that you two are looking for leadership opportunities both at the city and in our community, because you're certainly well qualified, as was Dante, and thank you very much for that. I'm also wondering, are there other veterans who are in the audience today? If you could raise your hand. And other city employees who are a part of the City African American Network, please raise your hands. Thank you for this presentation today. It reminds us the important work that we all do. Thank you.
Very good. I'll just say this, because I can't add anything to the stories that were shared here today except my thanks and my gratitude. And as we heard up here at the microphone, these veterans went to hell and back, and they did it for us. And now we owe them. And so thank you for the concrete suggestions that were all also made around the veterans, administration, and healthcare services, and what we can do to encourage the employment and economic prosperity of veterans in our community. And thank you for the courage that you exhibited by sharing your stories here today. I can't tell you how important it is that you did that. So thank you, all of you. So why don't we, could we reconvene here in front of the mics and get a photo? That'd be great. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. We are adjourned.
Get in here. There's always room for a good-looking guy like you. We'll make room.